Welcome on to a Friday afternoon edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. It's been a while since we just caught up on some news, so Danny LaRue is going to join me to do that. What's up, Danny?
Doing well, other than my sadness about the Exum news. How are you?
Yeah, that's really one of the sadder injuries because he's someone who I've always really liked as a player. Those who have followed my work for a while know that he was number two on my 2014 draft board. Unfortunately, now number one, Jabari Parker, and number two, Dante Exum on that board. For me, I've now both torn their ACLs within about a year of the draft. So really sad for Dante. I think that this has greater ramifications for him and the Jazz beyond this year, more so than just this year, because he was a second-year point guard. Basically, 20 years old, unlikely to be a great player for them this year, maybe their sixth, seventh best player, but still not good for them at all, is it?
No, it isn't. And it's hard because you think about somebody who made such a gigantic adjustment because he was playing functionally Australian high school basketball. He had FIBA experience, of course, but who made that jump to the NBA, and that the sophomore adjustment for him would be bigger than most because he gained so much experience in growing with the talent level. And so this was going to be an opportunity for him to have a better understanding of his game. And it was a disappointment also, he missed a fair amount of summer league due to injury as well. So it's unfortunate in that sense. And as you said, it could have ramifications beyond this year, but the importance for this year is big too, because the Jazz were a team that many people, and I believe this group includes both of us, had as a very serious playoff contender in a stacked Western Conference. And while that is still possible, because Exum was not even close to his peak, this isn't like you're losing, a guy in his prime, he was still going to be an important player for this team.
Last year, I think for the casual fan, and even for me as well, it was very easy to wonder what the big hype was about this guy, because he basically never drove to the basket, basically didn't hit a two-point jumper all year, essentially was reduced to a spot-up player, as Zach Lowe wrote in a nice piece right after the news came down. He basically was one of the worst pick-and-roll players in NBA history, had a humongous turnover rate, but nonetheless, you could still see it. He still had the great vision, great length on defense. He was able to be effective defensively, which, although it might have been overstated, he still has great length, unbelievable lateral quickness, and was someone who could potentially become a great defender in time. And for him to be able to be an effective NBA player on the defensive end at his age was pretty remarkable. Shows how conscientious he was, because he knew basically he couldn't do anything on offense, so he had to contribute in some way. And then in the summer league, just that one first game that he saw, a lot of the concerns that you had about him were starting to be addressed. He looked a lot stronger. He went up, he tried to dunk on people. He was blowing by Marcus Smart at times. He hit a few, two-point jumpers off the dribble, which he'd been completely inadequate at the year before. And granted, you don't want to get too excited about one game, but it's really just ashamed that we're not going to be able to watch him this year. That's really the biggest disappointment for me. Not even the fact that what it's going to mean for the Jazz bottom line in terms of win, but he was one of the guys that made this team so incredibly exciting to me.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to consider. And I think something else we should figure out is, where are they going to go from here? We've seen some conversations about maybe playing Alec Burks as a guy who defends ones, and they have a lot of players who can help run the offense. It's actually a benefit of Rodney Hood, who didn't start for them a ton. I mean, he played when Burks got hurt. But I'm intrigued to see how Quinn Snyder handles this, because it's late in the process, which means that there aren't as many options just around. But there are still ways for them to be a solid team, especially considering, but it's a position that's greatly important for them and any other team.
It is an interesting calculus for them now, because we saw that they didn't really do anything in free agency at all. I was a little bit critical of that decision just because dollars in this free agency go so much further. It was a chance to pick up another asset. They had great chemistry last year after the departure of Cantor. They didn't want to mess with that. I understand that decision, but they also really punted on an opportunity. Now, maybe they could make a trade during the year to try and pick someone else up. I understand why they didn't want to get a point guard. They have two young guys that they want to see what they have in Burke and Exum before his injury. But now you look at where they are, the point guard, they only have one point guard in Burke who has really had two terrible shooting seasons. He's pretty young. Maybe he can improve still. I did like him okay coming out of college, but certainly not a sure thing on a team that now has some real playoff aspirations. You know, you don't want to punt on the future just to sort of appease the fan base and get back to the playoffs. But this is an opportunity that they're going to have. And they have two extra first-round picks in the coming years, a 2017 unprotected from Golden State. Looks like it'll probably be pretty low with all the talent they have. And they also have that lottery-protected pick from Oklahoma City that'll probably be conveyed in either 2018 or 2019. So with those two in the war chest, they could potentially make a real offer for someone at the point guard position and then say that we can always just trade that guy again later if we need to, if Exum really develops. Or now you have the unfortunate possibility that you may not even really know what Exum is 3 years into his career when it comes time to extend him, because even next year he'll be coming off that ACL injury.
And as you said, it the recovery time on it, and you have a better idea of this than I do, it's probably more than a year. And when you're talking about an injury that occurs in August, that could extend into the following season. I don't think it'll extend that deep into it, but you're right that does affect it, especially when this is a Utah team that, while you can talk about how this year was a little bit more distant that they were going to be relevant, everybody on their team should be better even in 2016. And so you they're going to need everything they can get at that point as well.
Another component here as well is the pending free agency of Gordon Hayward. He can opt out at the end of next year, in 2017. With the cap being as huge as it is, he will actually be in line for quite a bit of a pay raise. This was the downside. A lot of people thought that Hayward really, the Jazz match, that was an overpay when Charlotte did that offer sheet to him, which was 3 years with a fourth-year player option. Utah waited out the market to see whether some team would max out Gordon Hayward. They, in fact, did. And that now, with the way he played last year, is looking like a very, very value contract, as Hayward's looking like the type of guy who could be a borderline all-star in the coming years. Granted, he didn't have a very good 2013-14, but I bet you the Jazz wish they had that solid fourth year or even a fifth year now on that contract.
Yeah, and that's something that it was always a dynamic with that class in particular, was just that the tide was going to turn so quickly that it always looked like a possibility. We're going to see the same issue with Chandler Parsons, though he has had health issues. And another thing that I was thinking about was how any of the free agent point guards waiting to sign, and the guy who I thought of is Jeremy Lin, because I think he signed for less than his value and not a great fit for him just in terms of playing time, that any one of those players waiting would have not only given them the possibility for more money, but given them an opportunity to really get playing time on a legit team.
Yeah, it's interesting. They certainly never really made any noise about trying to upgrade at point guard. I think that the type of move that I might consider if I were them would be, you already have so many young players. You're in a position now where, with the cap going up and with such shorter contracts, being able to trade for a superstar on another team is probably less realistic now than it ever has been. You still don't look at Utah as being an amazing free agent destination. There's been some talk that Eric Bledsoe might be available in Phoenix. Would you be willing to package that Warriors pick and that OKC pick and try and get someone like him, where you could now get one of the best defensive point guards in the league, just go all in on being, you know, just the number one defense in the league and being rugged on the boards with Favors and Gobert as well? That's something that I might consider. I don't think that that's really their mindset, to try and go for an upgrade. But I think that the plan maybe should change a little bit with how successful they've been, and with the possibility that Hayward could leave in 2 years. Maybe you want to try and get a little bit better now. That's just a thought that I had. I don't necessarily see them doing it, but I think that's maybe something that should be explored. If, for whatever reason, Phoenix, man, who knows what's going on with them? We'll get to them in a second. Would be willing to move Bledsoe, as was rumored earlier in the summer.
I love the Bledsoe idea. It also has the benefit, something that I liked about Exum. You talked about how you had him number two on your board. I had him number one. And part of the reason I liked him so much is that I thought he could play on and off ball and that he could defend both guard positions. Bledsoe can do the same thing. Bledsoe is a better player. He's already further along in his development. So putting them together allows you to do something that's a little bit different, because you can have them share ball handling responsibilities. You can also just make sure that at least one of them is on the floor all the time. If he were available, and if he were available at a reasonable price, I think that would be a great fit. They could also go more traditional point. You could do a lot of different things with Exum. It's part of the reason I like them so much. But Bledsoe in particular, for it's another one of those examples of when why teams build up assets for me is so that when another team makes a mistake, and I'm not sure Bledsoe's there. We don't know if he's on the market. We don't know what they take for him. But you want to have assets so that when that happens, whatever the case is for that, you have the resources to make them say yes to you.
I agree with you there in all respects, except for I don't see Bledsoe as that good of an off-ball guy. And that I think might be one reason why Phoenix might be interested in moving on from him, just because he's not that great of a shooter. But I do agree with you on his ability to defend both guard positions with his strength and length and athleticism. But we are getting a little bit far afield here on the Jazz. I would imagine they might try and see if they can get a more stopgappy veteran option type. Another one could be maybe Darren Collison, if the Kings are really going all in on Rajon Rondo, or maybe they'll just see whether Burke at least looks in camp, if not how he looks starting the year. Because if you are really trying to get to the seventh or eighth seed, then you can't really waste the first month and a half of the year until December 15th, when guys who signed over the summer can be traded, at least most of them, at least if you didn't sign it with bird rights. You might be totally out of it by then if you're not getting adequate point guard play. So we'll see. I think this is a chance for Trey Burke. David Locke was saying today that it's a good chance for him to kind of reset his career after his star had fallen in the organization, with the focus being on Exum. And we'll see. Maybe he can get to where he could become a little bit more of an effective player. He looked a little bit better as a first-year player and then didn't really take any steps forward at all last year. So maybe there's a little bit of hope still with him.
Sure. I think we're ready to move on to the Suns, which are, we talked about them a little bit earlier, but they're the factor in the other big conversation from the last couple of days.
Yeah. Now, this conversation, I haven't been quite as locked in on stuff. I've been busy the last couple of days. So I've just seen a number of references to the situation with Markieff Morris supposedly wanting a trade on Twitter. It's not quite as hard reported as I would have thought it was. John Gambadora, who does have some pretty good sources, a local radio guy in Phoenix, and has had some accurate reporting with the Suns before, reported that he basically wants nothing to do with the organization, hasn't talked to him since the offseason has ended, and of course is upset that they traded away his brother. I'm sure the organization in turn is upset that he and his brother went and got rung up on assault charges. But nonetheless, it's important to remember here the context of how he signed with or re-signed with Phoenix in concert with Marcus Morris in the first place last fall.
Yeah, so it was a very, very unusual deal that they signed for a combined amount, which was actually, I would argue, and I think you would agree with me, less than what they quote-unquote deserved, that they signed for a discount. And then the team basically let them split that money however they wanted. And that ended up yielding really affordable contracts for both of them. And so for Markieff Morris, he's making about $8 million a year for the remaining years of his contract, which is a gargantuan bargain.
Just kicks in this year too.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and so it's a great contract, and you know whether or not you're high on him, I know that you like Markieff a lot as a basketball player. It's one of those circumstances of, you know, the value, and as that, you know, the limited reporting that we've had has been out there. One of the things that has fascinated me is just thinking about the dynamics of it. So he's clearly a guy that's on a good contract, but he plays power forward, which is a position that has a lot of good players, though obviously a lot of positions do right now. And there are a lot of teams that are hoarding cap space. So, like, when I started thinking about potential fits, and obviously we're not sure if he's going to be traded or anything like that, certain teams I just checked off the list, like the Washington Wizards, because even though he would be a good fit with their talent, I don't think they want to cut about $7.5 million into their 2016 cap space, even if it's a very good contract.
Yeah, that's a point. And to go back, basically the idea was that the Suns, the Morris brothers are very, very close. They do all the same stuff. They have all the same tattoos. They basically work out together, follow the exact same schedule, live together, et cetera, et cetera. And supposedly neither of them did that well when they weren't together, when Marcus was on the Rockets and then the Suns traded for him. And both of their performances perked up, particularly Markieff's. And so they basically said, hey, here's $12 million, split it however you want. And certainly the expectation that seemed to be there that they were believed that they're going to be kept together. That's perhaps not a realistic expectation in today's NBA, especially then when you go and kind of get into this situation from a character standpoint. But nonetheless, while you may not believe it's justified, it's also not surprising that Markieff would be very upset with the organization right now. And the Suns had to have known that that would be the case when they traded away Marcus, you know, justified as they might have felt after these assault issues. I mean, it's like, you know, when your significant other is might get angry at you and you don't think it's justified, but on the other hand, you're still going to have to deal with the fact that she's angry with you going forward because you're together or Markieff Morris is on the team. So now the question is, if he indeed does want to be traded, if he is just totally out on the organization, what's the stance? Are they going to now try and play hardball with him? He's not allowed to directly request a trade publicly. So that's not something that he's allowed to do. But yeah, I mean, or they can try and accommodate him. So let me ask you this first. Do you think that they should try and repair it with him or try and play hardball with him a little bit and bring him into camp? I mean, he's obviously on a way, way below market deal at $8 million a year for a quality starting power forward.
I think that in a strange way, the way of accommodating him is by trying to talk about a trade, but only doing a trade if it's very good for you. So what that basically says is we tried, but we owe it to ourselves to do what's best for us. From a basketball perspective, what's a little bit frustrating about this, though, as you talked about the personal element, is that I love the fit of him next to Tyson Chandler. I think that it would be interesting to see him with that real defensive center, though we can worry about Tyson's health for a while. And what makes this challenging as well for Phoenix is that they just committed in the last 2 years to Brandon Knight and Eric Bledsoe. We talked about how the commitment to Bledsoe might be a little bit less strong than you just signed him to a bunch of money like they did. But at this point in the process, you're also sitting there wondering, okay, well, what would they want for him? Because if they want to be relevant this year, then you're probably looking at a power forward or a small forward, because those are really their only positions in need, unless they were going to do a bigger combined move with Bledsoe. So what I would do if I were them is I'd say, hey, you know, we will accommodate. We understand that you're frustrated. And I would say he's justified for it in the sense that if you were told these, like, if you knew the relationship and you said this is what's going to happen.
Yeah. And we don't know exactly what he was told, obviously.
Yeah. So you say, like, we understand that you're coming from this place. However, we owe it to ourselves, and you could say to you, to make sure that we only do a trade that works for us. So if we do one of those, if we can find a deal that works and that sends you somewhere and they're willing to give us enough, we will do it. If we do not, then we expect that you will be a professional and you will be here with us.
Yeah, he is certainly in his own mind, he's got to feel pretty aggrieved right now. Even if there weren't any assurances, he basically took way less than his market value to play with his brother. And now for the next 4 years, he's locked into really playing for half his market value. And if I were in his situation with a guaranteed contract and that angry, you have to wonder what his motivation is. He doesn't have a ton of motivation now, just basically locked in at this contract for the next 4 years to really try and bust it for an organization that he feels like betrayed him. So that could be a part of the really that they're dealing with as well. Let me ask you this. How good do you think he is? Assuming that he's still, if he tries hard, he's still the same player. I mean, maybe this whole idea of, oh, he won't be the same guy without Marcus, like, that's impossible to quantify. But so just based on how he's been the last couple of years, how good do you think he is?
On talent, I think he's definitely in the top 20 at power forward. I think you could make an argument he's in the top half. The truly elite group, I think he's not there yet, but he certainly has the talent to get there. He shoots the ball well. He can get better with that. He's a solid rebounder, and he's underrated defensively. I think that was something that I think Kevin Pelton talked about today, is that in his chat, was that the lines that were out there, and just in terms of on-off and things like that, it looks like he was a good defender last year. So if you put those pieces together, there's definitely a very good player in there. And so I think that's where his value is. And what I like about Markieff is that he provides value and he doesn't take a ton away. And those players are nice to have, especially when you're talking about somebody it certainly seems to me that he's comfortable being the third or fourth best player on a good team, because that's really what he is.
23rd in the league in defensive RPM, according to ESPN. I think he was in the mid-30s overall, a slightly positive player offensively. His traditional box score stats actually went down a little bit last year as he just shot a little bit lower percentage of the rim, shot a little bit more often for mid-range, but he actually shot 50% from 10 to 15 feet. And most of those, that's a very, very high number. Most of those are contested post-up plays. So he's someone who can get his own offense. He's a potential late clock option. And especially if he can stretch his game out just a little bit further to the three-point line, he's 25 now. You got having that player on a $8 million a year contract from ages 25 to 29. Very valuable indeed. There's a lot of power forward needy teams that I think could really deal with having him on the squad. And so with that sort of player on that kind of a contract, if you were running another team, let me put it a different way. If you're the Suns, what kind of an offer would it take for you to be willing to part with him, assuming that you're not under duress by this trade attempt, just from a pure value standpoint?
You'd have to get at least one player who is starter caliber and before their prime. I think that's more than fair. And it's probably not going to be at a premium position, meaning center or point guard, but you don't really need those anyway. So you're good. And I would say that because the Suns are in a difficult spot because, it's an identity crisis. Do they think they're a playoff team?
Before we lose it, let me just break in here. I would actually say that the wing is a premium position. That's where it's harder to fill. I think there are more good centers and more good point guards in the league than there are wing guys, especially because there's two wing positions to fill. But anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
That's fair. That's fair to say. That is an interesting point. I could rephrase what I said a little bit, but we'll save that for another time. But what I mean by it is, in terms of identity, is if they want to be relevant now, then that really curtails what they're looking for, because they have players at a lot of positions. They have Tyson Chandler at center. And if you trade Markieff mostly for, let's say, draft assets, that puts you back on the timeline, and you just spent a bunch of money on Tyson Chandler and Brandon Knight. And so I would lean towards just trying to find a team that has a need probably at small forward. That has a player at small forward that maybe is a little bit buried in the rotation that you can do something with, and then depth at another position. I think that's probably the best way, or a draft asset, which is, functionally a similar thing, just depending on what your priority is. But it's a challenge because the Suns went hard after the present. I mean, that was part of everything that they did, but alienating Markieff Morris makes that a very tenuous spot to be in.
Yeah, really. No organization has yo-yoed back and forth more over the last 3 years than the Suns. I mean, they basically had a terrible year in 2013. Then they were accused of total tanking and then had that amazing 2013-14 where they almost made the playoffs. Then last year, they were really trying for the playoffs again. That didn't work out. Then they got two first-round picks for Goran Dragic, traded him away. But then they got Knight, who is, sort of still a player that you would think, like, is someone that you want on a team that's about to start competing, where they had to start paying him. And with him about to be a restricted free agent, he's going into his fifth year. You got guys like Markieff. He's going into his fifth year as well. Eric Bledsoe. So you look at those guys and you think, all right, these guys are all coming into their primes. Maybe this team's ready to compete. Then they sign Tyson Chandler, and he's an older. You wonder what that means for Alex Len, but they still have all these draft assets. They have these young guys. And now if you trade away Markieff, who's basically the only viable power forward on the roster, then you really wonder where this team is going this year. They've just been yo-yoing back and forth. I'm not sure necessarily that they even have a concrete plan or vision for exactly where they're at or how they really can take the next step into the true ranks of contenders in the West right now.
And you don't have to necessarily have that vision. Obviously, it's great to have it. But the other move that I would throw in there is Isaiah Thomas. They sold low on him, too, in that sense. And, you know,
that's another one, right? They signed him. That's another kind of go-for-it move at the time. And then they immediately trade away him and Dragic, get Knight. It's just they've sort of been like ping-ponging back and forth here, and while still having a lot of talent on the roster and some intriguing pieces, but never really having a clear view of how you realistically are going to be able to get into that top tier in the West, unless you're looking at some of the young guys like TJ Warren really developing, maybe getting a premium piece in free agency. But as we'll reveal on our 2016 podcast, there's not really that many of those pieces out there in 2016. So really, I'm not really sure what's going on there and what to think. And then if they trade Markieff, they're taking a step. I don't think there's any way that they can get a player who will help them as much this year on the same sort of salary as Markieff does. I think it's got to be a few assets to get any sort of fair value on him. And now you're just kind of, taking another step back after the step forward of getting Chandler. So, yeah, it's really perplexing. And, I'm not saying that they've have been doing it wrong necessarily, but I do struggle to see where it is for them.
And this situation got even more complicated by the Jazz having the Exum injury, because that theoretically that makes it a little bit more plausible to get into that playoff mix, is particularly into the eighth spot, because the Jazz should be weaker than we expected, and they were a team that was right in that area as well.
All right, so let's get back to it then. If you're moving Markieff, what's an offer that's going to make you bite? Is it Toronto with that Knicks pick next year? I mean, is one first round pick that's sort of going to fall, 10 or later, is that enough to get you to bite?
If it's 10 or later, I don't think it is, because obviously it's
really, I agree with
you, going to be one of the weaker classes, and he's on a value contract. Was it something that I've talked about with other people with DeMarcus Cousins, is you are trying to hit in the draft to get somebody like this. And so with Markieff Morris, if you're sitting there at 10 and you end up with a guy as good as Markieff Morris, even 3-4 years from now, you're thrilled. And so if you can do it for that, and he's on a value contract throughout this time that the cap is going to explode, so you have a position that you have a quality player for, probably especially at that point, above league average at the minimum, and you're getting them for $8 million a year when guys of that caliber are getting paid $20 million a year, that's huge.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's really but that's, of course, all assuming. What about two first round picks? Is that get it done for you? I mean, both of them, assume that neither of them can be in the top 10. Let me put it this way. If I didn't know anything about his attitude, and I didn't know that the Suns had any kind of duress, and I weren't concerned about his ability to exist away from Marcus, just based on what he's been able to be on the court the last 2 years, his salary, especially if I'm one of these teams with a crap load of first round picks kind of just sitting there, and we talk about how those kind of become less or can lower in value as soon as the pick is actually made, I would throw that offer at Phoenix and see if I could get it, just because of the contract that he has. Now, does the fact that there are all these ancillary factors then it becomes a little more dicey to determine how much of a discount off of that value are you going to demand if you're a team that wants to acquire him.
And the team that I thought of, especially when you bring up the boatload of draft picks, is Boston. Because Boston, obviously, yeah, they were interested in Love. They were interested in Aldridge. They need a power forward at some point. Like, that is one of the things that will be a part of them being a good team. And if they're going to, even if they think they're going to be on the free agent market eventually, if you can fill that role with Markieff Morris and you still have basically a bunch of guys on rookie contracts and under $8 million a year contracts, you still have the flexibility to go out and get that small forward or some or center or however they see it with their draft assets. So that would be a team that could do it. Also, they have just a bunch of other value guys I've written about that I think that the Celtics assets are overrated. But at the same time, if you can give up some, you know, some lower end assets and get a guy like Markieff, that would be great for them.
I agree. Pretty much any team with a need at power forward, I feel like, should be making some calls on him. And
sure,
I think with, you know, I'm not sure that his defense is quite as good as those RPM type numbers would say, but still, I think a quality defender. It's got, can move his feet pretty well, strong enough to stand up to most post-ups, is quick enough to switch a little bit too if you need him to. He and him would suddenly be a pretty quality defensive front court. And if I were Boston, I would absolutely consider two of my kind of lesser in the war chest first round picks. I probably would not include any of the Brooklyn picks, but some of the other ones that they have going forward, including their own. I might consider even two. It all depends what the background says too. That's why you have scouts. That's why you have been doing background on all the players in the league for years and years and years. I'm not privy to just how bad he might be. And maybe he's not even that bad. Maybe it's just this brother thing that he's upset about. But that's all something to throw in there. And then the question of, all right, do I want to take a risk on this guy or not? And is trading two first-round picks for a guy who could be a risk? Well, hey, guess what? Those first-round picks are pretty big risks too. And they're not on starting players on great contracts going forward. I mean, that's the biggest thing, is what his contract is. That's what really gets me excited about him as an asset. So anyway, that's probably enough.
Why don't we can I do one small soapbox thing on that? Okay.
Oh, please.
This is why you don't take it. This is why you don't take a discount if you're a player. Unless you can get assurances that the reason that you're taking a discount will be there, don't take a discount, because that teams will take advantage of that. I think it was the Red Sox did that with Bronson Arroyo, and then they just traded him, because teams are going to behave in their own best interest. That is what they're going to do. Most teams make no buts about it at this point. And so if that's what you want, the team cannot make an assurance that that will be maintained. So just do what's best for you and sign the best contract. If you sign a discount because your brother happens to be on the team at that given moment, just don't make that mistake.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, especially because of the way that the cap was going up. It really is just probably an idea for him to do that. I agree with you. And yeah, it's not looking good for him. I mean, you know, granted, $32 million ain't nothing to sneeze at. Like, that should be enough to live on the rest of your life. But, you know, the way human beings work is you very easily adapt to your surroundings. You know, if you move into a great house, but it's the crappiest house on the block in a really nice neighborhood, all of a sudden, happiness research shows that people start to get upset about that kind of stuff. And same thing with Markieff, right? He's going to see guys getting paid these next 2-3 years that are going to be making double, maybe even triple what he's making, who are inferior players. And that's really going to bother him. And so even though he's making a lot of money to you and me, that's just not how human psychology works.
Yeah. You want to move on to Darrell Arthur?
Yeah, actually, why don't we do the Jason Thompson trade first? I didn't put these really, these are more in chronological order.
Sure.
But this was okay. Please, if you want to say it, if you got it in your head better. I think you wrote about this a little bit, didn't you?
I did. I wrote about it on Warriors World. And what makes this trade fascinating is the swap option that's in it. So what happened is the Warriors traded David Lee for Gerald Wallace a few weeks ago, and it was amazing that they were able to do that without sacrificing any assets because Boston wanted David Lee for some reason. Then they went to the Sixers, yeah, so who had acquired Jason Thompson.
They go from $15 million to about $10 million in salary there.
Yeah, and then they go down to about 7.3, I think. It's in my head. I don't have my sheet in front of me for Jason Thompson, but Thompson does have a little money in the next year. So the Sixers, they put a little bit more money on their books, which is fine because they're still not scratching the floor. I think they're getting closer to it, but they're not all the way there yet. And they got this really legitimately interesting swap right. So basically the way that I think about it is from the Warriors' perspective, because it's the easiest way to describe it, which is that the Warriors get the worst pick out of their pick, the Thunder pick, and Miami's pick. And so while there's a very reasonable chance that ends up being Golden State's selection, you know, who knows? And so it's another example for Philadelphia of buying, you don't want to call it necessarily lottery balls because I think everybody expects that the Warriors are going to make the playoffs, but just buying the possibility of something weird happening and getting an asset for it. So for the Sixers, they did a nice job of getting something that fits in a little bit better with what they want. The Warriors got a player who can contribute and who saves them a lot of money this year.
I don't think he's going to play that much for them, to be honest, because I think that they are now pretty much committed to playing with Barnes and Green as the main power forwards. The lineups with David Lee or Dixter power forward really did not work very well next to a guy like Bogut. They really want to play with the floor space a little bit more. So now the Warriors have a rather enviable position at center where they have essentially four options in Bogut, Azili, Spates, and Thompson. So now Thompson maybe can beat out Spates. He might even be able to beat out Azili at times. You know, he's sort of a decent compromise with his ability to hit from mid-range at least a little bit between Azili and Spates. But that said, especially with those guys having been around, I see him playing a ton for them. And I could also see them maybe moving on from him at the deadline, or maybe someone like Spates as well to save on the tax. Whoever those guys is looking like they're not really going to be in the rotation. Once they pay most of their salary, they could still save a ton of tax by moving on from one of them at the trade deadline. So we might see a move like that still in the works. I don't expect him to be a guy who's going to get a ton of minutes for them, at least unless the injuries really strike.
For sure. And that's the reason why I use the phrase can contribute, is that what you want ideally in a big man rotation for me is you want guys who can scale up. And the reason that you do that is because people get hurt. And so if Bogut gets injured, then you can slide, you know, you can slide these guys and fill those 48 minutes with the aforementioned three players. If Azili gets hurt, you can do that. And with the scope of an NBA season, while the Warriors stayed generally very healthy last year, you can't bet on that. So what you have now is you have another piece who saved you money, like they saved money in this trade, who can be used in that circumstance and whose contract is reasonable enough that you could move him to somebody at the end of the year. I mean, Jason Thompson was a guy who every once in a while you heard rumors about him being a potential fit in Cleveland for the trade exception that they've now generated for Brendan Haywood. They could go in other directions with that, but that's an opportunity as well if you want to get out of it. And so it's a piece to have that really didn't have much downside for them other than that swap thing I talked about before.
Yeah, and we'll see. The chances that the Warriors end up being worse than Oklahoma City and significantly worse than Oklahoma City are probably pretty low, but we'll see. I mean, you know, obviously if a Steph Curry injury happens, then the Warriors are kind of in big trouble. So as you said, the whole Sam Hinkie adds a few more ping pong balls to the lottery of life, as it were. Let's see. Let's get to a couple more of these here. We don't necessarily have to get to all of them but this is one that was interesting. People remember Josh Huestis, who was the 29th pick in 2014. There was a bit of a firestorm about him because he essentially agreed to be stashed in the D League for a year and not start his rookie scale contract until this year. They would not have selected him at number 29. He was sort of an off the radar fringe second round pick by a lot of people, but I think considered to have potential as a 3-and-D guy. Now they signed him this year, full 100% of the rookie scale. I was thinking maybe try and short him on that as well, but They did not. And so we'll see. I wouldn't imagine with all the myriad wing options that they have there that he will get hardly any time. I would even imagine him probably playing most of the year again in the D-League, but just making a real NBA salary. And the good news for OKC, at least if he does become something, he was already a senior, so I haven't checked, but he's probably around 23. Now you get him from 23 to 27, essentially, and right through his prime years as an athletic, potential 3-and-D guy. So pushing that clock back by a year really helps for them. And while people were up in arms a little bit about Huestis being able to do this and taking this go-to-the-D-League deal for a year, it's still a good opportunity for him that he wouldn't ordinarily have had. So I totally understand why his agent Mitchell Butler wanted to do that.
Yeah, my issue with it wasn't as much. Well, OKC was not from Huestis' side. I think that was fine for him. He got a resource that he was going to get.
It's who they should have drafted in that spot.
Yeah, one thing I'll mention is I think he got this is what you meant by it, but I think he got 120% of rookie scale, which is the full amount as opposed to 100%. But I could be wrong on that. But that's just a little nuance.
Oh, yeah, he did get 120. That's what I meant.
That's what you meant. I just wanted to clarify it because I know the Well Actually listeners will be into that. But anyway, but the issue for OKC is if you want somebody who's not going to take up a roster spot, but so don't take somebody who isn't worth a first round pick. Either take a Euro who's willing to stay overseas or trade your pick for something, because getting a guy who's a fringe second round pick for a first round pick doesn't make it better, especially when you give him 2 years of guaranteed money. It's a poor use of a resource. And so he'll turn 24 early in this season. So you will get those years. It's actually a kind of a counter argument that I made for Adrian Payne a couple of years ago, is the idea that if a player is really old, you get them for their prime. The same kind of thing with Taj Gibson. But if he's not that, if you saw him as being that good, then sure. You know, if you think he's an undervalued asset, you do that. But if he's not good enough to make your team, then you shouldn't draft him just because he's willing to take your discount.
Yeah, I know they're big believers in their development abilities, and so who knows? Maybe it'll end up being something in a couple years. But anyway, more really worth talking about just to kind of revisit that situation, odd as it was. A few more let's get to quickly. Pablo Prigioni to Clippers at the minimum, and that's a really nice signing for them, I think, because he's a nice yin to Austin Rivers' yang. Because he's just a caretaker type, cannot screw up, run the offense. If Rivers really gets out of control as backup point guard, that now gives Doc Rivers another option to go to in the game. Goran Dragic was traded to the Celtics in a tax dump. The Heat basically paid his entire salary, which it behooved them to do because they're so far into the tax, they're still going to save quite a bit, especially because they're going to be in the repeater tax this year. Interesting to go back and look at that decision by Phoenix to sign him. Yeah, sure made Goran Dragic happy there by signing him, right? Another, you know, it's really, I will say this, you know, I haven't done a comprehensive study, but these moves, whether it's, oh no, our prize free agent might leave, let's bring in Glenn Davis because Dwight Howard likes him, whether it's, oh no, we need to prove to LeBron James that we're really trying, let's make some short-sighted trades for Anton Jameson or something like that, you know, whether it's this move, just bring in his brother when he's clearly not an NBA player and everyone pretty much knows it, and now he's basically is pretty much out of the league for another team. Yeah, it's I mean, he at least got paid a pretty significant amount, which is good for him, but not really a move that worked out. I mean, there was not like there was a ton of opportunity cost there for the Suns to do that. You might as well at least try. I also thought it was surprising that the Heat felt like they're able to ship him out of town after Goran took a bit of a discount to stay with them, but presumably he knew that was going to happen, so I don't think that this is an organization that's been pretty big on loyalty. I would be surprised if they just turned around and stabbed him in the back like that. So, and I speculated they wouldn't be able to do that, but I guess he was cool enough with it.
How sad is Chris Smith that he can't even get into a montage of people who are assigned to make other people happy?
Matthew Dellavedova back to Cleveland for the $1.2 million qualifying offer. I think some people believed that he could get more than that, but and he had his in the playoffs. Really look at what he did all season. And if you even really look at the sum total of what he did in the finals, other than that one game and then getting the offensive rebound to win the game in game two for them in the finals, he really wasn't able to do much offensively. And if he's your backup point guard, I feel like you are going to be searching for an upgrade. And they did. They got Mo Williams, so he didn't have a ton of offers out there. He's just going back for the qualifying offer. He now at least will be able to veto any trades because they will have his birth, which he would lose if he were traded, being on a one-year contract. And he'll go into restricted free agency after his third year again next year.
He's a third point guard who's getting paid like a third point guard. The difference is that he's famous. So I think that, yeah, it's a nice signing actually for both sides, because his value as being closer to the 13th side of the end of a bench is actually very high, because he can defend, he can hustle, he's a good guy to have in practice. So he can do all that, but you don't have to put the burden on him of running the offense at all. And so I think that's a happy medium for him. And as you mentioned, something that confused some people in this, but the CBA, having two CBA nerds on the podcast, is that even though when you hear about a guy taking a qualifying offer, that means that he's becoming an unrestricted free agent. People can think of somebody like Greg Monroe. That is not true in this case, because since he wasn't a first round pick, it's about years of experience, not anything like that. This is more akin to what KJ McDaniels did. And so if you haven't accrued a sufficient amount of experience, which is 4 years, you're a restricted free agent in that group no matter what. So he is going to be restricted even though he took his qualifying offer.
Yeah, if you're a restricted free agent after your first 3 years, if you're a free agent after your first 3 years, as long as you're a first round pick who had your option declined, you are restricted. So that's what's going to happen with him. Andre Miller going to the Wolves. The more I think about this, I can't say I really get this one that much, because they already have the whole veteran leadership thing done with KG. Andre Miller, at least, is one of the greatest alley-oop passers of all time. So they just drafted a point guard in Tyus Jones, who I think they want to play. And Andre Miller isn't going there to sit on the bench. I don't think he's not happy in that role. So now I think we'll see that Tyus Jones isn't going to play that much this year, which is kind of too bad for his development. And I could understand the move if they didn't have someone like KG, but since they do, I don't really, it doesn't make much sense to me.
The only thing I can think of in terms of that is that Tyus Jones, kind of like we talked about with Exum, he's a very young rookie. And so usually those guys are not usually heavy contributors. However, unlike the Jazz, the Wolves aren't going to make the playoffs this year. So it's not like you're sitting in there that negative is a really bad thing for you. The negative for the Wolves is fine. That, you know, that makes you maybe a little bit shakier in terms of win-loss this year, but they're a year or two away anyway. So I agree with you that the veteran leadership angle is unusual for a team that brought a guy back and signed him for $16 million for veteran leadership. But at the same time, there are a lot worse ways that you can use one of those late roster spots. So I'm cool with it, though I do completely see your concerns.
Yeah, it's not like it's the end of the world or anything, but and maybe just Tyus Jones and maybe even Ricky Rubio a little bit can learn some from Andre Miller. So that's basically never doing anything in the summer and then just never missing a game. That works for everybody, right? Yeah. All right, one more here. We're not going to go through every single signing because these are getting to the point where we don't need to have a long discussion about them. I mean, it's kind of ironic that just because these signings are happening late in the summer and there's nothing really to talk about other than that we're talking as much about, you know, Josh Huestis as we're talking about like the Kawhi Leonard re-signing or something like that. But this one was interesting because it's another instance potentially of second round pick rebelliousness with the Sixers. There's a report that JP Tokoto will sign with the Sixers. And this was interesting because it was reported at the time was selected that he had agreed to go overseas and play and then come back. He was selected very late on, I think the 58th. But if you get selected with a draft pick, you have the option to say you have to give me a required tender and offer me an NBA contract this year or you lose my rights. Now, and they have to do that within the 2 weeks before September 5th. So with them, though, that required tender is just a one-year rookie minimum contract that's totally unguaranteed. And so I think what they were hoping was, let's see how this guy develops in Europe, and then we'll bring him back, give him a little bit of a guarantee, and lock him in for the Hinkie special four-year deal. He's not really interested in that. The difference between him and KJ McDaniels is KJ McDaniels was, I think, the 32nd pick was being talked about as a first-rounder, and Tokoto is nowhere near that class of player as the 58th pick. So maybe it's worth it to him, and if he just ends up getting cut, then he's a free agent. But I'm not sure that any other team is going to be beating down his door if he can't make the Sixers this year. So it's interesting. I mean, he did have the ability to force them to do that, if that's indeed what ends up happening. We don't know for sure yet, but we don't know what other teams have told him if he says that he can get away from having the rights and he gets or the Sixers having his rights and he gets cut. But especially if there are some talks that he was going to actually go to Europe in exchange for being selected, it makes us all very curious.
Yeah, it's a different kind of lottery in a way than what McDaniels did, but I'm excited to see how it works out just because I really don't like the current system. I don't like the exclusive negotiating. I've written about it before. And actually, I wanted to go in. There's what you said that was going to be the last piece. The other one that I want to talk about is Thanasis Antetokounmpo. And this is an example of chronology, which I thought was really interesting. I can go through it or if you want to go through it.
Yeah, please.
So one of the nuances with the collective bargaining agreement is that there is a minimum salary exception. So you can sign guys for the minimum salary, and if you're over the cap, even if you're over the tax, it's one of those that doesn't go away because that's how you build a team. You know, we've seen Miami Heat do that, Cleveland, lots of teams. But you're limited in terms of the number of years that you can sign a guy for. And so what happened with Thanasis is the Knicks had a bunch of cap space. And they were going to do, and they did what they were going to do with it. But by doing the moves in the order that they did them, all that they had left to sign him, who was a former second round pick in the 2014 draft, was the minimum salary exception, which is limited to 2 years. So as Albert Namad said on Twitter today, that he could have gotten 3 or 4 years, which presumably would have been years kind of like, as you alluded to, the Hinkie special, where you get those years, maybe they're non-guaranteed or team options or something like that. But he was limited to a 2-year deal because that was all the exception allowed. So the order of how the Knicks did their moves actually limited what they could do with Thanasis.
Yeah, that's true, because that minimum exception is only 2 years. And even if you're signing someone for the minimum for 3 or 4 years, you have to use the minimum salary amount of cap space to do that. He's only $75,000 guaranteed in the first 2 years from what I've read today. And also, I'm not really sure he's that good. He's got a famous brother, can't really shoot the ball at all, kind of an energy guy, but even who has really been like a startable guy in summer league, frankly. And from what I remember, didn't put up the most amazing numbers in the D League last year either. So this ultimately is much to do about nothing other than simply to just illustrate from a cap perspective that maybe they could have held off on some of their other signings to sign him. But as someone pointed out on Twitter, maybe they didn't even know that they wanted to sign him until summer league and getting into the summer practices. I don't know how good an excuse that is, but anyway, just another one of those kind of small things in roster management that the good teams get right. And, you know, probably won't hurt the Knicks, but maybe it could if he blows up to not have him on a 3 or 4 year deal, which they easily could have gotten considering how little guaranteed he has. Last thing, actually, from a CBA dork perspective, is the NBA Players Association is going to file a grievance against the Kings for voiding Luke Mbamute's contract based on his physical. I don't see how they win that, though. Do you?
It's hard because teams have discretion. You know, there's a reason that teams have discretion in this. And yes, he was cleared to play in the NBA Africa Games. I think it was 2 weeks after the Kings voided the contract that they signed him to. But team doctors have that in that. And, you know, there have been lots of reasons for that. And I don't think he was signed to I haven't heard the reporting, but it's just prohibitively unlikely that he was signed to a contract that would be so prohibitive that they would be having buyer's remorse. I mean, it seems more like he was probably on something minimum or minimum adjacent. But yeah, teams have the discretion to do that. Yeah. So yeah, teams have the discretion to do it.
Yeah, the rule is they have to conduct a physical within 3 business days and let the player know within 6. So, and they have, it is in the sole discretion of the team and their physician. And the reason it is that way is because presumably you're not going to agree on a contract with a guy and then just try and find some BS excuse to get out of it 3 days later. And medical terminology and medical exams are so nebulous that there's no real objective standard you can point to, especially in such a short amount of time too, where you're talking about where you need an exhibit 6, that's what it's called, where the contract is it's a condition of the contract that you pass this physical. His contract apparently had that on there and they didn't like what they saw and they decided they didn't want to sign him. But I really see no possible way, unless there's something really crazy going on here that we don't know about, that the union can win that grievance.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page.
All right, then. Anything to plug before we go?
So I just started the NBA Utopia project, which is on that started on the Sporting News, but the idea is for people to put stuff on the idea everywhere. It has a hashtag as well. And the idea that I alluded to this the last time you and I recorded is there isn't much going on in August in terms of transactions. It's a time to have kind of the big thoughts and the big conversations. And so what I'm going to do over the course of the next month is lay out the full vision of what I would want to do in the league. So that's what you saw in the early one was changing the schedule. I already have one on playoff structure, which people who have followed my work have already seen in similar forms. But going on to what you and I talk about a lot, which is the CBA, and I'm going to have a series of CBA pieces on thoughts of how to adjust it. And why I wanted it to be a little bit bigger than something, and I give lots of credit to Hoop Idea and to Henry and the whole group over there, is I like the idea of painting the whole picture because it forces you to think in a very different way. And so you can be realistic with it. You can be non-realistic with it. It's whatever makes you happy. I'm trying to go a little bit more abstract because that's just the way my brain works. But if you want to submit anything, the hashtag is NBA Utopia. I'm going to have pieces coming out the whole month. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun for me just putting all the things in my head and figuring out how to put them on paper. But I love anybody, writers, just fans, readers, whatever, to put in any ideas they want.
All right. Well, yeah, make sure to check that out. Programming note, Mike Schmidt's probably not going to happen until next week. I don't think I wanted to do this weekend, but I guess he's at a wedding. So that clearly takes priority. But he and I will talk about kind of what the summer has looked like, both from some of the rising high school players and then also the guys who might be draft prospects in 2016. He's been to a ton of events all through the July and August looking at that. And then Danny and I at some point soon will do a preview of the 2016 offseason, which should be a real fun one to do as well. So stay tuned for that. Thanks a lot for listening, and we will talk to y'all next time.